This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the
Tehran slams the UK Foreign Secretary's support for a London-based Saudi-funded TV channel, saying he is supporting the anti-Iran war room. Israeli forces killed two more Palestinian youths, one of whom succumbing to severe head injuries he sustained a few months ago. And the US authorizes $400 million in additional military aid to Ukraine, including weapons, munitions, and air defense equipment. Our top story: Tehran has strongly slammed the UK's support for a London-based Saudi-funded anti-Iran TV channel. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the British Foreign Secretary's claim to taking, quote, the importance of free, honest and open journalism incredibly seriously was just an empty allegation. He added that the channel supported by James Cleverly is freely propagating terror and violence against the Iranian nation and its national security. Kanani reminded Cleverly that his backing for the Saudi-funded Iran International Channel amounts to supporting the anti-Iran war room. Iran's intelligence ministry has designated Iran International Channel as a terrorist organization over its role in stoking the recent riots in the country. Tehran University Professor Sayed Mohammad Mirandi says the West-based Persian language media would have been immediately shut down if they were addressing the English-speaking audience, as they support the spread of violence.
There's no doubt that the Americans and the Europeans are deeply involved in these very violent riots, and we know they're violent because well over 40 police officers and Basij members were murdered by these different rioters. And the United States and the Europeans, if this had happened in their own countries, they wouldn't tolerate any of this. But these rioters are being egged on by Persian language media based in the West, largely in London, funded by the West and the Saudis. And these media outlets are calling the killings and the burnings and the beatings as legitimate. So Ofcom, if this was these were English language media directed towards English speaking countries, they would shut these television stations down immediately and arrest these people. But when it comes to Iran, it's all fair game.
Tehran says reaching an agreement regarding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal is high on the agenda. The foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, stresses that the Islamic Republic is insisting on its red lines, saying that a deal is quite feasible if Tehran's demands are met. Gisu Mishahmadi has more.
Deal or no deal? While the EU is still reluctant to lay its negotiating cards on the table, at a press conference in the capital, Tehran, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian stressed that Iran's negotiating team is ready for the next round of talks and is waiting for the bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, to set a date for ministerial-level negotiations.
We have made our stance clear, and in the previous negotiations, we communicated our views regarding the remaining issues. Last week, we announced that we are ready for the next round of talks, and now Mr. Borrell is following up and trying to set a date. Obviously, talk will continue if we make sure that our logical demands are met.
In the words of Hossein Amir Abdullahian, resolving the remaining issues with the IAEA, receiving guarantees on the economic benefits of the deal for Iran, and removing unilateral sanctions are the three key issues that need to be worked out.
The JCPOA revival talks are high on the agenda, and we are adamantly following up on the issue. Of course, this will happen when we make sure that our reasonable demands in line with our national interests are met.
According to the top diplomat, Iran and the U.S. continue to exchange messages. However, American officials take what Amir Abdullahian calls a hypocritical stance while talking to mainstream media by making comments that contradict the messages that they send to Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has always deviated from its technical path and taken a political stance. European and American negotiators had promised that this would not happen again, but they broke their promise yet another time.
These comments come after a recent anti-Iran resolution passed by the IAEA Board of Governors prompted the Islamic Republic to announce that it will begin 60% uranium enrichment in its Fordo nuclear facility. Over the past couple of years, Iran has demonstrated in practice that it is committed to the JCPOA, or the nuclear deal. It has always been the other side that has neglected the agreement. Now Iran says for these negotiations to reach a final conclusion, it is necessary for the other side to offer some guarantees that it will remain committed to any agreement that is reached. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Israeli forces have killed two more Palestinian youths as the regime's atrocities continue unabated across the occupied Palestinian territories. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 22-year-old Mohammed Hisham Mohammed Abu Kushk succumbed to injuries he sustained after being shot in the abdomen by Israeli forces during a raid in the city of Nablus. Meanwhile, Mohammed Ahmed Hassan Herzaleh, aged 30, also succumbed to severe head injuries he sustained about 4 months ago in July. Herzaleh was a former prisoner who had been arrested by the regime's forces in late 2013 and spent a year and a half in jail. The new fatalities increased the total number of Palestinians killed since the beginning of this year to 202. The figure includes 150 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and 52 in the besieged Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Israel has approved the construction of hundreds of new settler units in the occupied West Bank, defying international outcry over the measure. According to Palestinian media, the regime is to seize 120 hectares of land in Wadi Rahal, village south of the city of Bethlehem. The plan also includes the construction of 7,000 more settler units in Bethlehem in its next phase. Israel's Supreme Court has turned down an appeal by Palestinians to prevent the settlement expansion plan. Thousands of Israeli settlers live in settlements built since 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and Al-Quds. All Israeli settlements are considered illegal under international law. The UN has time and again condemned Israel's settlement expansion policy, calling on the regime to stop such activities.
Illegal buildings. The land on which these sprawling complexes were built upon belongs to the people who didn't want to give them away. These are Israeli settler units. Israel has been building such settlements since it occupied historic Palestine. Historians believe the first Israeli settlement was established in the occupied West Bank. Palestinians, however, say the first was Tel Aviv itself, and that every inch of their land that was turned into a settler complex should be considered illegal. After the military incursion of 1948, Israeli armed forces subsequently began constructing settlements over the ruins of Palestinian towns and villages, covering 78% of occupied areas. Israel launched yet another war in 1967, in which it captured the remaining 22% of historic Palestine. Since then, Israel has been expanding its settlements, both in terms of the area they occupied and in terms of population. At a time of military raids, many Palestinians fled, leaving their homes and land at the mercy of occupying forces. But that was not the end of the story, as the regime continued its expansionist agenda by bulldozing remaining Palestinian homes under various pretexts. Figures show that some 50,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished since 1967. The enterprise is so vast that the regime set up roadblocks and checkpoints and constructed barriers and walls to protect the settlers and limit Palestinian movement. The appropriation of land and water sources for settlements led not only to a loss of livelihood for Palestinian farmers, but limited the urban development of Palestinian towns and cities. Settler violence under the protection of the Israeli army is also a routine occurrence Palestinians have to endure. Such violence ranges from torching Palestinian farmlands, destroying property, to armed and arson attacks. Ironically, when Israel's Western backers talk about a so-called two-state solution for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they seemingly forget about the illegal settlements that critically undermine the Palestinian right to self-determination by limiting the possibility of a contiguous state. Will it ever be possible for the Palestinians to have truce with those who are continuously undermining their existence? The Israeli defiance in terms of its expansionist and brutal activities and its total disregard for the will of the international community shows that it is not interested in peace at all.
Moving now to the war in Ukraine, where Kiev says Russia has fired some 70 cruise missiles at targets across the country. It says the Russian attacks have caused disruptions to electricity and water supplies nationwide. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, joined us earlier with more details. Let's take a listen to that.
Well, yeah, this has been a massive strike from Russia today, one of the biggest strikes so far in this war targeting energy infrastructure. Now, I've just been speaking to a contact in Kiev. Before the strikes of today, there were huge problems with electricity in Kiev and across Ukraine. Citizens there only had 2 hours of electricity a day. Before that was scheduled, they knew when it was. Then it became random, so they didn't know when they're going to get electricity. It's very disorientating for people in Kiev. It gets dark about 4 o'clock now, winter is kicking in, they get home and there's no electricity. Heating is working, water was working. Heating, of course, very crucial. The winters are severe here in Ukraine. But after today's strike, right now in Kiev, there's absolutely no electricity, there's no water, and this is the same right across Ukraine. We do expect that Ukrainian authorities will be able to get back some of this electricity and get water running again. But this is the lowest point in terms of the situation for normal civilians across Ukraine that they've had to endure in this conflict so far. Russia's strategy of hitting energy infrastructure is clearly having a big impact. Ukrainian authorities say that they're able to shoot down most of these missiles. They're clearly not. Russia is able to hit anywhere it wants in Ukraine at any time. Their strategy here is to try and bring Ukraine to the negotiating table, or some are suggesting maybe preparing for a major assault from Russia in the coming weeks. But it's increasingly becoming difficult for Ukraine to look after the most basic needs of its citizens. And that may well, Russia will hope that may well change the political motivations or political desires or what's strategy the Ukrainians and indeed NATO decide to go with moving forward.
The U.S. has approved $400 million in additional military aid for Ukraine, including weapons, ammunition, and air defense equipment. According to the Pentagon, the package included additional munitions for NASAMS air defense and HIMARS rocket systems. The State Department says one of the goals of the new package is to help Ukraine repel Russian attacks on the country's energy infrastructure. The new package raises President Joe Biden's administration's total military assistance to Ukraine to about $20 billion. U.S. allies such as Britain, France, and Sweden have also announced aid packages for Ukraine. Russia has warned time and again that continued supply of Western weapons and military equipment to Kiev will only prolong the war. Political commentator Arnold August says the West's real goal of arming Ukraine is to prolong the war.
I'm not so sure if the West is really interested in Ukraine winning the war. Even some of their own advisors and generals have to admit that it's practically impossible for Ukraine to win that war. But what they are interested in doing is prolonging it. They're looking for a very long, drawn-out war in order to keep the military supplies going to Ukraine. And this has to be necessarily on the basis of lies. For example, the British Prime Minister said today that Ukraine is successfully pushing back Russia. That is not the case. So there's a whole series of lies going on, which is key for them to keep this myth going that Ukraine can win.
Elsewhere, Scotland's bid for independence from the United Kingdom has hit a roadblock following a ruling by Britain's apex court. The Supreme Court has said the Scottish Government does not reserve the right to hold a second referendum on whether to break from the UK without permission from London. The British Prime Minister has welcomed the court's decision, describing it as clear and definitive. But Scotland's First Minister has strongly criticised the move, saying democracy is threatened.
In the meantime, the SNP will launch and mobilise a major campaign in defence of Scottish democracy. For we should be in no doubt, as of today, democracy is what is at stake. This is no longer just about whether or not Scotland becomes independent, vital though that decision is. It is now more fundamental. It is now about whether or not we even have the basic democratic right to choose our own future.
Sturgeon said that Britain's next general election would be a de facto vote on Scotland's secession. The first referendum on Scottish independence from the UK was held in 2014, but the move failed as only over 44% of the voters then said yes to independence. Sturgeon and her pro-independence party say there's now a, quote, indisputable mandate for another plebiscite, considering the UK's exit from the European Union. Activist and commentator Mick Napier says Scottish people have the right to decide whether or not they want to secede from the United Kingdom.
I don't think that this decision in London by the judges will have a positive effect as far as London's concerned, because it brings together two different things. One, the percentage, the proportion of Scottish people who want independence, and a very large number really want that independence passionately. The numbers of those who are prepared to vote for independence seems to be pretty strong as well. But now we throw into the mix not whether you're for independence, but whether Scots have a right to decide themselves on independence. And I think this is Sturgeon's strategy, is to raise that issue of democratic rights. Opinion polls in Scotland were showing that trust in the London government was vanishingly small. It was below 20% of people who thought that they could trust the London government. And whether deservedly or not, those who were prepared to trust the Holyrood Parliament in Edinburgh was in the very high 70s, almost 80%. So the problem's not going to go away.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
A German official has sounded the alarm to people, warning that the country is facing serious electricity shortage in the country. Since the start of Russia-Ukraine conflict in late February, Germany has offered substantial military support to Ukraine, sending the country billions of dollars in military aid and heavy weaponry. Russia has in turn cut off gas supplies to Europe, causing a worsening energy crisis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, many households in Germany will take another hit from rising energy bills in January as power and gas suppliers face higher wholesale market prices and soaring grid fees, Reuters has reported, citing the Verivox prices portal. A Verivox energy expert, Thorsten Stork, said in a statement, the price level for energy is historically high and reducing the purchasing power of households. The portal has monitored 800 electricity and 700 gas providers and found that 137 regional power operators are set to increase prices by an average of about 61%, while 167 German gas suppliers are planning a price hike of roughly 54%. This could result in an overall increase in energy prices of more than 50% in Europe's largest economy. The electricity bills of German families in November have risen by 5% since the start of the year, while gas bills surged by more than 40% above January's level, Reuters said. According to Verivox estimations, the extra average cost for a household using 4,000 kilowatt hours of electricity per year would be 784 euros, while a typical household using 20,000 kilowatt of gas could see an increase of 1,247 euros per year. Such a dramatic price growth in energy-dependent Germany stems from the plummeting supplies of Russian gas and lower nuclear output in France, which is struggling to restart all of its reactors ahead of winter. Experts say that energy inflation is likely to continue despite a package of emergency measures by the government. Also, Press TV reported President of the German Federal Office for Civil Protection and Disaster Assistance, Ralf Tissler, said in an interview, "We have to assume that there will be big blackouts in Germany in winter." He added, "We have to expect blackouts in winter. By this, I mean a regional and temporary interruption in the power supply." Tissler said, adding that the power cuts were due to both energy shortages and temporary shutdowns of the entire grid to protect the entire network. The official further added that he was referring to short-term power outages, so-called brownouts, rather than larger-scale blackouts. Tissler warned that the situation could potentially reach a critical point, urging Germans to stock up on food, water, and other essential supplies. The last couple of years have been really tough for Germans, Tissler said, adding that the COVID-19 pandemic served as a prime example of the unforeseen effects of a crisis. The coming years are yet to be more challenging in light of the worsening climate situation and other serious and geopolitical tensions, Tissler pointed out. He said the saddest part of the news was that the European Union, at the confederal level, denies the hardships that normal people were going to face in winter. In related news, a major German grid operator told media in early October that the country may be forced this year to cut its electricity exports to other countries in order to survive in winter. Hendrik Neumann, chief technical officer of German electricity grid operator Amprion, told the Financial Times about potentially cutting off electricity exports to other countries to avoid local shortages. Neumann said in the interview that temporarily pausing exports of electricity for hours rather than days could be a last resort to salvage the country's embattled energy crisis, which has been in the eyes of the storm since gas supplies from Russia were cut. According to Press TV, France and Austria are the biggest importers of Germany's surplus electric power, whose energy crises could deteriorate with any switch off of German exports. Neumann said the Ukraine crisis was one of numerous overlapping issues contributing to Europe's energy crisis, worsened by the shutdown of over half of France's 56 nuclear power plants and low water levels on main rivers delaying coal shipping. He claimed that while Amprion ignored political and ideological aspects, he didn't agree with the comments from Economics Minister Robert Habeck, who said in July that Germany didn't have an electricity problem. If that was the case, we would not have been asked by government to conduct a special analysis on the electricity market in winter, he noted. He added, the government needs to draw the political conclusions and take the political responsibility. The government decided in September to postpone the decommissioning of 2 out of 3 nuclear power plants in the country, saying it will keep the 2 plants running until at least April. Germany shut down 3 nuclear reactors in 2021, and shutting the remaining 3 would officially mark the end of the nuclear phase-out of domestic energy production. The government said it would still need to make a decision about extending the lifespan of the power plants beyond April, and that decision would be dependent on the nuclear power plant situation in France. Media reported last week that France risks running short of electricity for several days this winter as a result of lower than usual nuclear plant availability, citing the country's grid operator. According to Électricité de France, EDP, repairs and maintenance on almost half of its nuclear plants may turn the country, a traditional power exporter, into an importer this year. Under this scenario, French customers would have to pay a premium to their neighbors, where prices have been soaring lately, the report said. The French government has called on businesses and households to conserve energy to avoid blackouts. In the event of a possible electricity shortage, grid operator RTE will launch an eco-watt red alert 3 days in advance, demanding reduced consumption. France, which generates roughly 70% of its electricity from 56 nuclear reactors, all operated by EDF, had just 31 of those online recently. The company said last week that it aims to have more than 40 units in operation in December and January. In the meantime, media reports said the price of electricity in Germany and France for 2023 has soared to new records due to the European energy crisis caused by the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Also, according to AFP, in Germany, the price of electricity for the year ahead reached 850 euros per megawatt hours in the stock market. The year ahead contract in France's bourse market passed 1,000 euros recently. Compared to last year's price, 85 euros in both countries, the year ahead contracts in both countries' markets indicate a stark rise in energy prices. Soaring energy prices coupled with runaway inflation have put the livelihood of Europeans under heavy constraints. After the Europeans severed their energy ties with Russia, the main supplier of natural gas to Europe, over the Ukraine conflict, triggering a dire economic crisis on the continent. The shutdown of several nuclear reactors in France due to corrosion issues has contributed to the electricity price increase, as power production has dramatically decreased in the country.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies, sisters, mothers, all the Muslim ladies out there. Welcome back to another session of your favorite program, Muslim Lady. This is Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host, and here with me, I have Sister Zainab as the guest who's going to help us with knowing more about how should a Muslim lady leave. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to your program.
Wa alaikum assalam, Sister Asma. Thank you so much for having me.
It's been quite some time that we've been working on a book, which Sister Zainab is working on it, and then giving us some important hints and important ideas about the book, which is, all in all, generally talking about the ethics
and lifestyle of ladies,
yeah.
Assalamu alaikum, written by Dr. Muhammad Reza Jabbari.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's the lifestyle of Sayyida Fatima Zahra. And we are actually getting familiar with how she lived, the manners she went through. We talked about table manners. We talked about adornment. We talked about resting. But I guess something is remaining from the resting part, which was related to sleeping, to the time we devote for sleep and something like that.
Yeah, so resting part is basically when you go for sleep and when you wake up. So we did when we go for sleep and then went to wake up and all, those also have ethics. Islam has taught us like all, and we have practically seen that in our best role models and Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family, their life. And right now we are just focusing on the life of Lady Zahra, salamu alayhi. So we ended our last session with the sleeping ethics, wherein Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, he advised Lady Zahra, salamu alayhi, O Fatima, don't go for sleep before you carry out these four. What was that? That was to complete the Holy Quran and make all prophets as your intercessors. And every believer should be satisfied with you and carry out Hajj and Umrah. And then when Lady Zahra sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, I am not capable of doing all that before sleep. How do I do that? And he smiles and tells her, if you recite Surah Tawheed for three times, it's as good as you, it's like it gets the reward of completion of whole Quran. So we as Muslim ladies can have our wise brains,
yeah.
We can use our wise brains, like I want to do, I will make sure that I complete the Holy Quran tonight before going to bed, and suggest that to my children, suggest that to my husband, suggest that to every member of the family. Hey guys, do you know we can complete whole Quran just before going to bed, and that too in just 1, 2, 3 steps, and that is reciting Surah Tawheed three times. And then he tells her, if you send salutations on me and the prophets who have been before me,
We all will be your intercessors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so easy. Like, it's just one line sending the salutations and salam on the prophets.
And I remember the last session we talked about this very thing, that you said that if Muslim ladies focus about this very tiny steps, then they would turn their bed into the mosque.
Into the mosque, exactly. You know,
yeah.
A sleeping bed would turn into a mosque and would get more and more rewards. You are actually making your resting place a spiritual place. You're
mm-hmm.
reaching heights, the levels of spirituality. And then how all believers will be satisfied with you. Forgive them. Forgive them and ask for their forgiveness. When you pray for them, that's how all believers will be satisfied with
you. Well, right at this moment, let's go for a short break and we'll be back to continue what we're talking about. Thank you, Muslim ladies, to stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Muslim Lady. In here, I am Asma, your host. And here with me, I have Sister Zainab. We're talking about the rituals of sleeping and resting and the things that we should take into notice before we go to bed.
Sister Asma, I had been talking about sending salutations on Prophet
mm-hmm.
and forgiving the Muslim believers. I would like to expand it a little. Like, when we send salutation, what does that mean? We always, you know, start our salutations with salam. And even the word Islam is a, you know, combination of these words. Salam means that I surrender. I surrender before you. When you're sending salam, it's not just, hey, salam, salutations on you. It's not like that. It is like, I am surrendering before you.
Yeah.
And go for sleep. You are tired, working throughout the day. Now you want to make your...
You're worn out, actually, throughout the day. You've been doing too much of jobs and chores, perhaps.
And something that irritates your mind the most is, like, if you did something wrong somewhere. So, you know, just surrender in front of your Prophet.
Yeah.
Actually, when you surrender things, you are mentally making yourself feel better. And then you also are doing what Prophet, may peace be upon, has
mm-hmm.
suggested us. And when you every night go and surrender before them, send salutations. Salutation sending means surrendering, actually. When you surrender before them, they will be intercessors tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like they will be intercessors as such. Then we said, forgive the mu'mineen, forgive the believers. Ask for their forgiveness. Okay, if someone went wrong with you, you show greatness. You forgive them. And that's really hard with ladies.
Yeah.
That's really, really hard because we kind of keep that, you know, something that's tough in our heart and that pinches us all the time. Why she went wrong that way? Why he did like this? Why this and that believer did like this to me? He was not supposed to. We are not like, you know, very, very easy in terms of forgiving people. But see what Lady Zahra is doing all the time. And even Imam Hassan al-Islam asks her, why are you praying for others? When for us? She says, first neighbors.
And then us.
And then us.
Yeah.
See,
so
like,
since she is the role model of all the Muslim ladies out there, we're just focusing on
showing
how,
you, she's telling you how big heart you should have.
Mm-hmm.
First
others. Though she's the daughter of the Prophet.
Yeah.
And she could go very much easy.
Yes. You know, because a woman is so, so powerful, she can destroy a generation, she can enrich a generation, she can take them towards what we call as sa'adat, real sa'adat, she can take them towards real prosperity.
Salvation.
Salvation, prosperity, the entire generation she's going
mm-hmm.
to bring about. So she has to have a big heart. She
yeah.
has to have a forgiving heart. She has to talk about believers. See, for example, someone is pinching you. Someone is irritating you. Someone is not nice with you. Don't talk behind him, number one. And then if you're not able to take it out of your heart, you know, guide yourself in the way. See, Sister Asma, if I am cleaning my house and I am putting all the dust in the dustbin and I'm not throwing that out, what is the fun of my cleanliness? What is the fun of that? I work all day. I cleaned my home. What is the fun that I put it all in the dustbin?
Actually, there is no use in that.
Because all the smell will spread out back into my house.
And there'd be no good in cleaning your place.
I may not be harmful, apparently, to others, but I will keep a grudge deep
inside
within my
myself,
heart towards the believers, towards who did something wrong to me. So in order to clean up my soul, it's recommended, say istighfar, say the zikr, say the, you know, recite the zikr of istighfar.
And ask forgiveness of Allah every night.
Yeah, ask for that. That's the, for example, someone says, okay, I take a shower, that's a shower of my body, but what about the shower of my soul? The shower of your soul is reciting istighfarullah, asking for forgiveness. So ask for your forgiveness and, you know, forgive believers. Once you forgive believers, that's that way, on that day, no believer will be, you know, having grudges with you, basically.
Exactly.
Because it's all women who have grudges with each other, who have grudges with others. I'm not degrading them, but I'm saying they have a very, very soft heart. They're not able to take it out of their heart. But see, if you're taking this out of your heart, you're basically cleaning your soul.
Yeah.
It's benefiting you. Because if you're putting there, it's somewhere stinging within your soul, and your soul will smell bad.
Mm-hmm. So what I get from what you're saying up until now is that as a Muslim lady, I have to clean my soul every night, because the womb of a woman is the place where a generation is going to be created. And if this mother has a pure soul, and if this mother is very much careful about every single act she takes through her life, then the other generation that is going to come in future is going to be a prosperous one. Is going to be a generation that knows what is the true path and follows it directly. So this is actually what we have for
not only hair, but also, like, you know, if you have a child who sees, like, my mother keeps grudges, he will turn into a revenging child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. So mothers are actually the models for their children, whether it be the son or the daughter. So that's why we're mentioning all these facts, which are coming out of the life of Sayyida Zahra Salamullah Alayha. So dear listeners, let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you for staying with us. Welcome back here, ladies. This is Muslim Lady, and we're talking about another aspect of Sayyida Zahra Salamullah Alayha's lifestyle. We were going through some ideas, which was telling us that every single night we can do too much before going to bed. And then Sister Zainab told us that these are important, actually, to take care of, because a mother is the beginning of a new generation. She is the one who's going to be the teacher for her children. That's why she has to be very much careful about every single move she takes in her life and consider God in every single step, so that her children are going to follow her steps.
Yes. Thank you, Sister Asma, for that summary. Again, so we were talking about what Prophet recommended Lady Zahra Sallallahu Alaihi had to do before sleep. And we, as ladies who are torn out throughout the day, who are, like, done with everything, who are energyless, you can, with that small energy, complete the whole Quran. You can achieve the satisfaction of all believers. You can achieve the intercession of all prophets. And you can also carry out Hajj and Umrah by just reciting Tasbihat Arba'ah. What is that? That is to recite 100 times the four zikr. What is that? That is Subhanallah, Alhamdulillah, Wa la ilaha illallah, and Allahu Akbar. What we recite in the third unit of our prayers. So that's what was recommended before sleep. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some ethics that are related to waking up.
Yeah.
When to wake up. And
And I guess we're going to go for those ethics for the coming session.
Inshallah.
Yeah. Thank you, Sister Zainab. You actually went through some very fruitful ideas. Thank you so very much, dear listeners, sisters and brothers, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, for lending us your time and attention. You are listening to your favorite one and only Muslim lady. If you've missed any episode or you wish to stay tuned to the latest topics and discussions, you can visit parstoday.com. With a click on A Call of Islam, all your favorite programs will pop up and you could find a boundless archive of any topics of your interest. Also, if you have any suggestions or ideas, you could send your emails at englishradio@irib.ir.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, jurors will decide if the actions of the founder of Oath Keepers Militia, Stuart Rhodes, amounted to a seditious conspiracy, which carries significant jail time. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. As angry supporters of President Donald Trump stormed the US Capitol, ready to smash through windows and beat police officers, Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes extolled them as patriots and harked back to the battle that kicked off the American Revolutionary War. Next comes our Lexington. Stuart Rhodes told his fellow far-right extremists in a message on 6th of January 2021, "It's coming," he said. Jurors will begin weighing his words and actions on Tuesday after nearly 2 months of testimony and argument in the criminal trial of Stuart Rhodes and four co-defendants. Final defense arguments wrapped up late on Monday, 21st of November. Hundreds of people have been convicted in the attack that left dozens of police officers injured, sent lawmakers running for their lives, and shook the foundations of American democracy. Now jurors in the case against Stuart Rhodes and four associates will decide for the first time whether the actions of any January 6 defendants amount to seditious conspiracy. a rarely used charge that carries both significant prison time and political weight. The jury's verdict may well address the false notion that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, coming soon after 2022 midterm election results in which voters rejected Donald Trump's chosen Republican candidates who supported his baseless claims of election fraud. The outcome could also shape the future of the Justice Department's massive and costly prosecution of the insurrection that some conservatives have sought to portray as politically motivated. Failure to secure a seditious conspiracy conviction could spell trouble for another high-profile trial beginning next month of former Proud Boys National Chairman Enrique Tarrio and other leaders of that extremist militia group. The Justice Department's January 6 probe has also expanded beyond those who attacked the Capitol to focus on others linked to Donald Trump's effort to overturn the election. In the Oath Keepers trial, prosecutors built their case using dozens of encrypted messages sent in the weeks leading up to 6 of January 2021. They show Stuart Rhodes rallying his followers to fight to defend Donald Trump and warning they might need to rise up in insurrection. "We aren't getting through this without a civil war. Prepare your mind, body, and spirit," he wrote shortly after the 2020 presidential election. Three defendants, including Stuart Rhodes, took the witness stand to testify in their defense, a move generally seen by defense lawyers as a last resort option because it tends to do more harm than good. On the witness stand, Stuart Rhodes of Granbury, Texas, and his associates, Thomas Caldwell of Berryville, Virginia, Jessica Watkins of Woodstock, Ohio, sought to downplay their actions but struggled when pressed by prosecutors to explain their violent messages. The others on trial are Kelly Meggs of Dunellen, Florida, and Kenneth Harrelson of Titusville, Florida. Seditious conspiracy carries up to 20 years behind bars, and all five defendants also face other felony charges. They would be the first people convicted of seditious conspiracy at the trial since the 1995 prosecution of militants who blew up New York City landmarks. The trial unfolding in Washington's federal court, less than a mile from the Capitol building, has provided a window into the ways in which Stuart Rhodes mobilized his group and later tried to reach Donald Trump. But while authorities combed through thousands of messages sent by Stuart Rhodes and his co-defendants, none specifically spelled out a plan to attack the Capitol building itself. Defense attorneys emphasized that fact throughout the trial in arguing that Oath Keepers who did enter the Capitol were swept up in the spontaneous outpouring of election-fueled rage rather than acting as part of a plot. CNBC has also covered the same story. For the first time in at least a decade, a jury is set to deliberate federal seditious conspiracy charges, weighing the government's case against members of the far-right Oath Keepers militia, who prosecutors say plotted to oppose the peaceful transfer of power by force in the lead-up to the attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6 of January 2021. The founder of Oath Keepers, Elmer Stuart Rhodes III, is facing trial alongside four other defendants, Jessica Watkins, Kelly Meggs, Kenneth Harrelson, and Thomas Caldwell. Jessica Watkins, Kelly Meggs, and Kenneth Harrelson went inside the Capitol building during the attack, while Stuart Rhodes and Thomas Caldwell were present on restricted Capitol grounds on 6 of January. Stuart Rhodes repeatedly tried to get in touch with former President Donald Trump even after the January 6 attack, encouraging Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act and call upon the Oath Keepers to help keep him in the White House despite his election loss. After hearing from the U.S. government last week and from the defendants' attorneys on Friday and Monday, federal prosecutors got the last word during rebuttal before the case went to the jury late on Monday. They took matters out of the hands of the people and put rifles into their own hands, Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Nessler told jurors. They claimed to wrap themselves in the Constitution. They trampled it instead. They claimed to be saving the Republic, but they fractured the Republic instead. The defendants should be held accountable for agreeing to commit sedition against the government of the United States of America, Jeffrey Nessler said. They are not above the law. We ask you to uphold the Constitution that they tried to subvert, Nessler said. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta told jurors they would begin deliberations at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday and resume deliberations on Monday after the Thanksgiving break. Federal prosecutors have not proven that the Oath Keepers had an organized plan to storm the Capitol building before 6th of January. Instead, they say the alleged co-conspirators agreed to oppose the peaceful transfer of presidential power, including by using force. Jason Dolan, an Oath Keeper who testified that he was ready to die to keep Donald Trump in office, told jurors that the Oath Keepers seized the opportunity to storm the Capitol building when they got the chance. I wanted them to be afraid of me, Jason Dolan said, referring to members of the Congress. If they weren't going to, in my perspective, do the right thing, maybe they could be scared into doing the right thing. Graydon Young, another Oath Keeper who cooperated with the U.S. government, said he thought he was part of a Bastille-type moment in history on 6th of January 2021. I guess I was acting like a traitor against my own government, Graydon Young said. Three defendants, Stuart Rhodes, Thomas Caldwell, and Jessica Watkins, took the stand in their own defense during the trial, which began with opening arguments on 3rd of October. Stuart Rhodes testified that he never directed anyone to go into the Capitol building and that he said after he learned the Oath Keepers had gone into the building that it was stupid for them to have done so. But the government played a video of Stuart Rhodes praising the patriots who stormed the Capitol and a recording of him saying that his only regret about January 6th was that they should have brought rifles with them. Prosecutors also showed that Stuart Rhodes tried to send a message to Donald Trump after the attack on Congress.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.